you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow. You're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Okay, welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, bastion of bourgeois liberal values.
And I am your co-host, Michael Walsh, the guy who runs the meme page, Homegrown Socialist and Homegrown Syndicalist.
And Bernie Vermin?
Vermin Sanders.
Vermin Sanders, yes.
Well, that's my...
That's the backup.
That's not a page, that's my alt profile.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, this show covers news, issues, and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy in a commons economy, a left that it's of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts.
Awesome. Now, you can probably get commentary about Trump getting COVID or the debate elsewhere. This is the place for the hardcore, not so, but also hopefully accessible. Please let us know if it is inaccessible and what we can do to make it more accessible. We can't fundamentally change who we are, but we can adjust. This is a humdinger episode we got. So we got a funny thing to do in the middle, but we're going to bookend with readings. We're both going to switch between a place of criticizing socialists and the MLs from the past, you know, communist parties of the 30s, from a book called The God That Failed, as well as a historical reading about just that makes me feel very apoplectic. But it gives us food for thought. Then... about the future, short-term and long-term. Then the meme, we're going to have a really funny meme that also is pretty educational if you actually look up what each of the parts mean. And I think it's equal parts educational and funny as we can laugh at ourselves and the subcultures that online leftism creates. So let's start right away. So I have from a textbook that I got from a library book sale at the college. From it was published in 79. Ooh. So it's from a kind of older perspective, but it's Readings in European History, published by a professor, edited by a professor in Boston. So that's the perspective it's coming from. But anyway, these are kind of the readings. Like, I love primary sources because it gives you kind of the on the ground, less, I mean, there's the framing from the editor of this textbook, but otherwise this is like, these are their words, this is their feelings. And this is from the interwar period in Germany, 1930. And the readings called from two German women. But first, some context. An article from Vosges Zeitung, one of the newspapers at the time. In Germany, unemployment has reached 4 million. But wherever the... And of course, do I have to explain that this is the context of, like, well, fascism rising, economic dislocation, right. Yada, yada. Does this sound familiar to you? But wherever the employment of men has dropped, the number of working women has increased. Already today, 75% of all women work. As a result, 6 million employed women confront 4 million unemployed men. We have, for example, more than 20,000 young teachers without jobs, but the number of female teachers, and even those who are married, grows ever larger. A similar situation exists in the other professions. The state is providing the good example in this regard. Private industry gladly follows. How shocking is the fact that when men in the prime of their life, who have wives and children to feed, are thrown out on the streets, How scandalous is the condition when everywhere young girls are given preferential treatment in hiring? No cabinet minister, no party has raised this aspect of unemployment or knows any way to counter it. They fear losing votes. But Germany will self-destruct if the women can work and the men are forced to be unemployed.
Wow. Yeah.
Self-destructed. Damn dead. So two German women describe their workday. Now this, I read this when I was, the first one is 26 years old. I read this when I was first, I first read this when I was 26.
Oh, wow.
And you're close to 26 too, so.
Almost there.
Almost. But anyway, this is they're just describing their normal work week.
Right.
Okay. The alarm clock utters a shrill cry at 5:30. Still, so this is from an HHB, 26 years old. Still very drowsy, I get out of bed, put some cold water in the basin, subject myself to a sponge bath from head to foot. Only then do I feel refreshed, as if reborn. By the time I've gotten dressed and combed my hair, it's already 6. Then, after another quarter of an hour, I sit and have breakfast. At 6:15, I get up and go to work. It is not far, 5 minutes away. But in spite of that, I always go a little early, since I don't want to get tired out so early in the morning. I leave 7 or 8 minutes for myself to rest and think. At 6:30, the siren signals the beginning of work for 8 hours, or with some seasonal work, 9 or 10. I stand on a wide plank and remove stains. That is, I remove all the stains from clothes, which are to be taken for cleaning. This is not so simple as one might think. One has to watch that the material is not damaged through brushing or that the colors don't fade from the acidity. For a trifling bit of damage, I resign myself to a severe morality sermon. Many, many clothes pass through my hands. Some of them I like and others I would like to get one or the other for myself, but that is not possible. My salary is so low I can't afford such expensive clothes. My hourly wage amounts to 49 pfifling, and that, with the wages of my mother, who also works, must pay for the entire household. Rent, coal, lights, everything. Since my father is unemployed and provides for nothing. As a result, clothing comes last for me. I cannot call my work boring. Change comes with the variation of the pieces, but my colleagues at work are not ones whom I would choose for myself. They hold to the old ways and are crazy. They cater to the bosses and hold firmly to the church, attested to by the fact that they go to prayer with the lists of petitions to God, which they've collected. Also, they are not organized into a union and are not to be won over. So I stand on my plank and think and brood about how I can bring my colleagues to worker consciousness, how I can win them over, so that they will stand with us and fight for better salaries, for better living conditions, and for the liberation of the working class. So I meditate and think until, in the middle of these thoughts, the siren sounds as proof that my work in the factory has ended. Exhausted, I go home, and then begins the work at home. Cleaning, washing dishes, supper, cooking supper, I am seldom finished before 8 in the evening. Only Sunday is a different day for me. I get up early and go by bicycle to a meeting point from which the young socialists ride out onto the Hurf and collect new strength from nature. I spend beautiful, lovely hours there, which serve only enough to get me through another working week. That, in turn, provides my livelihood and, unfortunately, profit for the capitalists.
Mm.
Any thoughts on that? Or reactions?
I thought it was very applicable to what we're going through right now.
And the conversation we have, Sierra, last week about kind of outreaching to the people that, like, how do we make them class conscious? And the fact, or the fact that, like, at 26, let's say you're working some service job and you're just kind of, you don't have the energy or time to do the solid organizing work.
Right.
But you want to be organized, yeah, or in a union. And then you're surrounded by people like, how do I reach out to them? I just don't know.
Honestly,
and just brood.
I think one of the best ways to reach out is to say what we want and what we hope to achieve without the buzzwords. Because really, it's the buzzwords that are the most alienating aspect.
That's the usual advice, and I do get some mileage out of it. And also, like, there's also the question of, like, learning what others' values are, where they're coming from.
Right.
And that itself is, like, a job in itself. Because it's not like you have all these other people out there who are doing that work, that emotional labor. I would say, like, you have, you know, sort of like pseudo smart guys like Joe Rogan who maybe pretend that they're empathizing with others when
right,
really they don't actually put in any of the labor to understand others' positions. They just kind of say, like, oh yeah, we're so different and we have, like, can't we just meet in the middle? And it's like, you don't put in the effort to understand how poor people think, you know.
Right.
Or like maybe you were a schlub at one point, but then you've been rich for quite a while now. And that goes for any personality like that. So the other reading is from an anonymous woman, someone who's a bit older, a mother. Since my husband became unemployed, I have been forced to go to work. In order that things don't become too disordered, I must bear the share of the housekeeping for my family, which consists of my husband, three children, aged 3 to 13, and me. My residence in the district of Zeitz, and my workplace is a wool combing factory where I am a cleaner. Since I have almost an hour train ride, I get up early, about a quarter. Notice these German women describe their schedule very precisely with the times. And the other thing I would mention is the whole, like, the double duties that they have to perform. They're not only the working women of the household, they also have to still do all the housework. They can't trust the unemployed men to do it. They just, they can't even be bothered to learn. And thus they mull about in the beer halls being organized by the Nazis. And in our case, the Proud Boys are 3%, whatever. Their numbers are not large, but they're organized at least in the milieu of, they're not organized at all, that's the thing, but like they get pulled into the culture of Trump land. Then there was more work to do at home. I have to prepare the food, get ready, yada, yada. When you aren't there all day, things are abused a bit more because the little misbehaviors aren't seen. In the evening, you are worn out and exhausted from the long hours, so the clothes, the underwear, the stockings have to be mended on Sundays. Sometimes I have to sacrifice my sleep, too. Since I attend the party and worker welfare meetings, and even preside over the latter as chair. On Saturday, I arrive home about the same time. Then I usually go shopping at the Cooperative Society for food for the whole week.
Yay.
Every 4 weeks, I have to do a huge washing for the family by myself. What is more, the night before, Saturday, I have to get everything ready so I can begin early Sunday morning. As a rule, my Sunday starts about 7 a.m. Since there's house cleaning and clothes, so even Sunday isn't really a day of rest. So it goes day in, day out, week after week, the daily life of a working woman, the worker's fate. So the greater context of this, of course, is that this is 1930, and things for these socialist women, socialist-minded women, are going to get really bad. And to know that the years that they're spending before things get really bad, the big crisis, the big reckoning, is like they're just surviving. They're just trying to make kind of get through. They're kind of doing what we're doing for the last decade. And that kind of gives me the sense of unease that, you know, maybe others sort of have. Or I feel like it's clarity of, like, this has been done before. The way we go about things. Because we're all in the trap of our society, so to speak. Now, the other, and that everything they were doing or trying to do to make life better, and they were making their life sort of better. Like she said, she organizes with the Welfare Society, so then there's this cooperative. She also says she's a party member, you know, but offhand, like it's not important, or it's not like the thing she's doing.
Right.
So I can then expand by talking at length about with this book, The God That Failed, which is published in like 49. It's one of those books that are like, this is how bad communism is. We need to lock up all the communists. Or this is why, like,
right.
So the readings from the stories from three ex-communists, people who left the party but were in it in the 30s and left by the beginning of World War II. First one is a German man, Arthur Koester. His deconversion was because he was jailed by Franco. And when I would consider it, that his story is like he was mentally broken. He was listening to people getting shot for months at a time, just waiting for his turn.
Yeah.
His turn didn't come, but it gave him this religious experience that just like the clarity of like the world that the communists fight for is irrational, or that the values that we were holding just like do not like matter or something like that. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it for sure. I could read the whole passage, but the passages I do want to get to were more applicable to maybe like the things like I like ranting about, like entryism. But in this case, he's actually talking about the Communist Party. Almost that, like, even while they're, like, street fighting the Nazis, they're still kind of LARPing to some extent about, like, they're fighting their underground campaign and that they were preparing. They spent 2 years, instead of actually campaigning in the streets and winning elections, or, like, he mentioned that when they went out door knocking, their main talking point was about Japan's abuses in China, not the needs of Berliners.
Yeah, focus on what the people you're talking to care about.
Because so, if you didn't already know, these parties were very dogmatic and cult-like in their, you know. But this is most political organizations or any organization, and that's why us Americans individualistically distrust formal organizations. They give orders. They create social pressures that we just destroy our freedom and so on. And the only way
sounds like unjust hierarchies to me.
Exactly. And so I feel like we can, if we have formal organizations that are more decentralized and have a more horizontal organization, Occupy, Green Party, other types of organizations that exist today, but just need to be filled out and worked on, we can do things better than these people did in the past. So I want to go on how I want the message that we're getting from this to be that we can learn from their mistakes as well as like the things that they were doing well. And I'll, there's another passage I want to get to that goes into that. So like he mentions that like one of the things they use to kind of brainwash you is to send you to the Soviet Union and do a little tour. But then of course you encounter how not brainwash, but just like how brainwash is not the right word, but it is a culture of like, sticklers and like not understanding what liberalism is, because when you come from like you have a king, like you literally had a kingdom that was serfs and then you organize into some modern publishing company, you're just thinking, of course I'm going to follow orders, the line from the party is this and this is the way we do things, and it's all very tit for tat, and it's like you want to be merit based, that's alien. It cannot exist. The second psychological factor helped me to carry on after my return from Russia. So this is like, you know, he's getting weary of like the party activities. He's just kind of a cog in the machine of the party. It took him like a bit of doing the join because of the distrustful factor and the how he, you know, he's aware of maybe how it comes off as a crazy person, but he was trying to like influence this younger guy working under him.
Right.
Because he was... You know, it's like they did an infiltration kind of thing, too. It's like, oh, you work at one of the liberal newspapers. Keep your post there. It's like, no. I want to do party writing. You know, or I want to do party journalism. Like, no. You're more useful to us there. You know, infiltrate, inform us on what's going on in the newsroom kind of thing. So it's like, yeah, the commies, the reds are everywhere and they're spying on you and they're, you know, they're working for the party. Like, yeah, this is actually how they operated to some extent. Yeah. But were they effective or... But then the projection starts when it's like they're really effective, they're really insidious, and they're really like they're going to take over any moment now. It's like, no, it was actually quite the opposite. So his point of view is like it was all really time-wasting stuff. Instead of organizing people effectively with good messaging, the orders from Moscow were internationalism first, let's talk up China's woes and argue about the position on China.
All right.
So anyway, the second psychological factor that helped me carry on after my return from Russia, it was a conviction shared by the best among my friends who have now either left the party or been liquidated. Though we were blinkers, we were not blind, and even the most fanatical among us could not help noticing that all are not well in our movement. We were never tired of telling each other and ourselves that the party could only be changed from inside, not from outside. You could resign from the club, from a club, and from the ordinary sort of party if its policy no longer suited you. But the Communist Party was something entirely different. It was the vanguard of the proletariat, the incarnation of the will of history itself. So that's something of a religious belief. Once you stepped out of it, you were extramutos, and nothing which you said or had any slightest chance of influencing its course. The only dialectically correct attitude was to remain inside, shut your mouth tight, swallow your bile, and wait for the day when, after the defeat of the enemy and the victory of world revolution, Russia and the Comintern were ready to become democratic institutions. Then and only then would the leaders be called to account for their actions, the avoidable defeats, the wanton sacrifices, the mud stream of slander and denunciation in which the pick of our comrades had perished. Until that day, you had to play the game, confirm and deny, denounce and recant, eat your words and lick your vomit. It was the price you had to pay for being allowed to continue feeling useful and thus keep your perverted self-respect. I like this passage because it's I feel it describes the existence of party functionaries, yeah. Whether you're in the Republicans or the Democrats. Because this is the attitude progressives have when they're running for office, and
right.
as them socialists or stuff like, we're going to change it from the inside. Look, we want to criticize Pelosi and say how, you know, the corporatists are our enemy, but we got to play the game. We can sort it out after the election. We can always sort it out after the election. There's all these memes, if I may rant for a moment, about like, once we beat Trump, then we can build the boat. You know, Biden is a life raft off the sinking ship that is Trump America, as if it's all one thing.
Right.
And it's like, when are we going to build our own boat? It's like, you're never going to do it. You say like, yes, I want to argue about the Green Party and join, not join, or have a practical third party. I mentioned. And it's like, when you said that last cycle and the cycle before that, it's like, when are we going to do it after? Like, we're going to do it next time.
Well, that's why I'm really looking forward to like the day after the general. Because that's when...
Well, it'll be the week or so. Week well, or so yeah. But yeah.
And that's when we're going to be like, all right, screw it. It's time for the Green Party. Let's move over.
Maybe. If we lose if we lose ballot lines, though, because... So this is the thing that I'm worried about now, is like we might lose our ballot lines if we don't get enough progressives to switch over in safe states. We'll lose all the momentum. We'll be back where we were in the aughts. And... then it'll be like we have the same, like we have to have the fight anyway about, because you have some in lefty groups that correctly point out that some of our weakness comes from how decentralized our organization is, that we have state parties that are just on paper, that we have many greens that are just on paper, because we're not a formal organization. We are decentralized, but also more informal. You have a tyranny of the active. The people who show up to the meetings the most are the people who call the shots. And in some states, those are just ex-Dems who just have an axe to grind against former Dems or party, you know, or they just have their own like personal agenda.
Right.
Which kind of Dario Hunter came off as at the end of the day. Richard White, author of Native Son and other kind of mid-century classics. Ooh. He was a Communist Party member through the John Reed Club. These were like artist clubs that existed. And then he kind of transitioned to being in the WPA, which where you're actually paid a living wage or at least a minimum wage to make art once the New Deal got rolling. Hmm. And it got rolling because it had the support of communists like, you know, Richard White. So let's see. Let's go to page 128. Good. Okay. So like, let me give you a summary. So he's first joining the club, and some of the club members are Communist Party members, and then there's kind of a factionalism between them.
Oh, okay.
Because the party members were painters,
hmm.
but him and the other members were writers, producing a poetry mag, the New Masses.
Okay.
And so here we go. I had attended a few meetings. So it was also mostly white people, but also a number of Jews. And he was suspicious, like, what are these white people? They're so nice to me. He just couldn't, like, it's from the South. And he's just like, why, like, they must want, like, are they really nice to me just because they want some black member? Or they actually, like, want me to be part of this? And, you know, he learned that, no, they do, but also as long as you're in it, you know. I attended a few, but here's, like, the first jolt of, like, dishonesty or kind of machinations. I had attended but a few meetings before I realized that a bitter factional fight was in progress between two groups of members of the club. Sharp arguments rose at every meeting. I noticed that a small group of painters actually led the club and dominated its policies. The group of writers that centered on Left Front, the magazine they were editing, resented the leadership of the painters. Being primarily interested in Left Front, I sided in simple loyalty with the writers. So when you're actually in an informal group, like in Occupy chapters,
right.
this is the dynamic that occurred. But instead of like painting versus writing, it was like what tactics? Direct action versus pressuring politicians.
Okay.
Or lobbying or something like that. Then came a strange development. The Left Front group declared that the incumbent leadership did not reflect the wishes of the club. A special meeting was called and a motion was made to reelect an executive secretary. When nominations were made for the office, my name was included. I declined the nomination, telling the members that I was too ignorant of the aims to be seriously considered. The debate lasted all night. A vote was taken in the early hours of morning. Show of hands, I was elected.
Wow.
Later, I learned what happened. The writers of the club had decided to use me to oust the painters, who were party members, from the leadership of the club. Without my knowledge and consent, they confronted the members of the party with a Negro, knowing that it would be difficult for communists to refuse to vote for a man representing the largest single racial minority in the nation, insomuch as Negro equality was one of the main tenets of communism. So they used some identity politics there. Very shady. But then he and others joined the party eventually because it mattered.
I just want to interrupt for a quick sec.
Go ahead.
I'm scrolling, and modern satire is incredible. So I just read an article.
A little tiring for me, but.
I read an article titled, Paw Patrol Replaces Chase the Cop with Carl, the Antifa Rioter.
Yeah,
I've
seen that.
The picture of the Paw Patrol cop in.
The Dalmatian.
All full communist gear. With a brick.
This is how we're changing. Yeah, this is how we're changing the country. No more cop characters.
No
in kids
more
media.
Cops. Only rioters.
Well, remember in Scooby Doo, you couldn't rely on the cops. You know, you had to investigate yourself.
Well, every Scooby Doo episode ended with them unmasking the capitalist,
the white land developer,
exactly,
who wanted to just develop land,
and then giving him to the cops. So, like,
yes,
but
the cops didn't.
I'd say Scooby-Doo was helpful in radicalizing the youth, but not as helpful as it could be.
There are some memes about that, yeah. There's a few more places here where I think are really good points. So, other points in his journey are actually going to the communist unit meeting. So, like, it's mentioned both by the German as well that they, in the formal organization, you had units that were in your neighborhood.
Right.
So it was sort of bottom up, but all of the ideology and the orders were coming from the top.
Okay.
So very hierarchical. And that's where it's like, look, it's not the communism or the equality that's the problem here. It's the hierarchy and the dogmatic way that the beliefs, you know, the beliefs of that you needed to have to be an effective member. And he goes into that, of course, but there were conflicts in the fact that he was self-educated and this was distrusted. He was a black man from the South, but he was a writer and he spoke well, or he spoke in proper English. And this may, like, you know, they snickered at him when he went to the first unit meeting and they all got a joke like, hey, it's good to have a writer among us, comrade. But he was like, what are you snickering at? You know, it's like, you know, he's ready to fight. But as he's grown older, he's like, he doesn't fight anymore. But like he has that instinct. This is where, like, so after he wanted to, you know, he wanted to do what a good writer wanted to do, and he wanted to focus on writing. And like when a conference was called of John Reed clubs, he's like, he wanted to make it about craft, even about like what we write about. But then, like, no, it was handed over to political issues. We need to discuss political issues, not the art. But he's called into basically the party boss's office because after a long, you know, a few years of him trying to write about people's experiences. This is like suspicious. Like he's choke him second. He has to, you know, stand up straight and go like, you know, do you not trust me? You think I'm going to inform on the cops when you tell me your story? It's like, fine, don't only tell me what you want to. But even then, he was, you know, associating with someone who was more nationalist, black nationalist.
Yeah.
And this was no bueno to the rest of the party, which is internationalist and world struggle and all that. So this is so he's calling to the party bosses. His name's Nelson. Yeah, he was all like he was called a Trotskyite, despite never reading any Trotsky, but just the fact that he wasn't hardcore, like, you know.
Well, if you don't like Stalin, then you're a Trotskyite.
But he did. He liked Stalin. He liked what he had to say about colonialism. This is where he's like, these people are crazy. They're my friends. They're my colleagues and comrades, and they don't trust me because I speak well and I have my individual pursuits. I want to write, right? Yeah. But he also wants to write for the cause, but they don't want that. They don't care for that. Yeah, okay. They tell me you're a friend of Ross. This is the guy he wanted to write about. I paused before answering. He had not asked me directly, but had hinted in a neutral, teasing way. Ross, I had been told, was slated for expulsion from the party on the ground that he was anti-leadership. And if a member of the Communist International was asking me if I was a friend of a man about to be expelled, he was indirectly asking me if I was loyal or not. Ross is not particularly a friend of mine, I said frankly, but I know him well, in fact, quite well. If he isn't your friend, how do you happen to know him so well? He asked, laughing to soften the hard threat of his question. I was writing an account of his life. I know him as well, perhaps, as anybody, I told him. I heard about that, he said. Right, haha, say, let me call you Dick, huh? Go ahead, I said. Dick, he said. Ross is a nationalist. He paused to let the weight of his accusation sink in. He meant that Ross's militancy was extreme. We communists don't dramatize Negro nationalism, he said in a voice that laughed accused and drawled. What do you mean, I asked. We're not advertising Ross, he spoke directly now. We're talking about two different things, I said. You seem worried about my making Ross popular because he is your political opponent. But I'm not concerned about Ross's politics at all. The man struck me as one who has typified certain traits of the Negro migrant. You know, this is right after the Great Migration, and right. This is Southside Chicago. Mm-hmm. I've already sold a story based upon the incident in his life. Nelson became excited. What was the incident, he asked. Some trouble he got into when he was 13 years old, I said. Oh, I thought it was political, he said, shrugging. But I'm telling you that you were wrong about that, I explained. I'm not trying to fight you with my writing. I have no political ambitions. You must believe that I'm trying to depict Negro life. Have you finished writing about Ross? And he goes on. Okay, so you're a funny guy, he said, laughing, snorting again. But we've got a job to do. We're altering our work. Fascism is a danger. The danger now to all people. So this is like in 34.
Right.
I understand, I said. We've got to defeat the fascists, he said, snorting from asthma. We've discussed you and know your abilities. We want you to work with us. We've got to crash out of our narrow way of working and get our message to the church people, students, club people, professionals, middle class. I've been called names, I said softly, and this is after a long line of like kind of low-key right. bullying. Is that crashing out of the narrow way? Forget that, he said. He had not denied the name calling. That meant that if I did not obey him, the name calling would begin again. I don't know if I fit into things, I said openly. We want to trust you with an important assignment, he said. This is like his last chance. What do you want me to do? We want you to organize a committee against the high cost of living. The high cost of living, I explained. What do I know about such things? It's easy. You can learn, he said. I was in the midst of writing a novel, and he was calling me from it to tabulate the price of groceries. He doesn't think much about that. What I'm trying to do, I thought. Comrade Nelson, I said, a writer who hasn't written anything worthwhile is the most doubtful person. Now, I'm in that category, yet I think I can write. I don't want to ask for special favors, but I'm in the midst of a book which I hope I can complete in 6 months or so. Let me convince myself that I'm wrong about my hankering to write, and then I'll be with you all away. Dick, he said, turning in his chair, waving his hand as though to brush away an insect that was annoying him, you've got to get to the masses of people. You've seen some of my work, I said. Isn't it just barely good enough to warrant my being given a chance? The party can't deal with your feelings, he said. Maybe I don't belong in the party, I stated in full. Oh, no, don't say that, he said, snorting. He looked at me. You're blunt. I put things the way I feel them, I said. I want to start and write with you. I've had too damn much crazy trouble in the party. He laughed and lit a cigarette. Dick, he said, shaking his head. The trouble with you is that you've been around with all those white artists on the north side too much. You even talk like them. You got to know your own people. I think I know them, I said, realizing that I could never really talk with him. I've been inside of 3/4 of Negroes' homes on the south side. But you've got to work with them, he said. I was working with Ross until I was suspected of being a spy, I said. Mm. Dick, he said, spoke seriously now. The party has decided that you are to accept this task. I was silent. I knew the meaning of what he had just said. A decision. So this is like a justification of the hierarchy, okay?
Yeah.
I think this is important to understand. A decision was the highest injunction that a communist could receive from his party, his group. And to break a decision was to break the effectiveness of the party's ability to act. In principle, I agreed with this, for I knew that it was impossible for working people to forge instruments of political power until they had achieved unity of action. Oppressed for centuries, divided, hopeless, corrupted, misled, they were cynical, as I had once been, and the communist method of unity had been found historically to be the only means of achieving discipline. In short, Nelson had asked me directly if I were a communist or not. I wanted to be one, but my kind of communist, but my kind. I wanted to shape people's feelings, awaken their hearts, but I could not tell Nelson that. he would only have snorted. Quote, "I'll organize the committee and turn it over to someone else," I suggested. "You don't want to do this, do you?" he said. "No," I said firmly. "What would you like to do on the South Side, then?" "I'd like to organize Negro artists," I said. "But the party doesn't need that now," he said. I rose, knowing that he had no intention of letting me go after I'd organized the committee. I wanted to tell him that I was through, but I was not ready to bring matters to a head. I went out, angry with myself, angry with him, angry with the party. Well, I had not broken the decision, but neither had I accepted it wholly. I had dodged, trying to save time in writing, time to think. I really like that, like, the justification of, like, unity of action is something that we're missing. Like, yeah. There's no left in America because there's no unity at all. And the lesson from the past seems to be that, and this is what the quote-unquote tankies would say and why they are the way they are, is that they're trying their damnedest to convince others that this unity of action requires this hierarchical structure. And this is after decades, generations, in fact, of individualistic, basically rights way of thinking. That, like, yeah. Let's focus on the feels. Let's focus on changing people's minds with art and counterculture. And it's interesting that, like, you have calls for a new counterculture. We need to keep fighting the culture war, or we need to, you know, do with memes. This is what meme culture is.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, we're still not building our political power. Does it require taking orders? Does it require going back to this kind of dogmatism? I cannot believe that. I feel that we have tools that they don't have, because he mentions in some meetings and stuff, like, that orders had to come down from the party, right? This, what's missing is that decision, and this interaction is, like, the decision was made without talking to him or considering
right.
his actual skill set. He's like, I don't want to tabulate grocery prices. I want to write poetry.
Right.
And this is what I want to be good at, as well as it is what I'm better at.
And that's, like, one of the things I really like about the Green Party, is that, like, I haven't really felt a lot of pressure to do anything other than the things that I'm good at. Like, I can make a meme. Like, I can make memes, I can spread our message, and I can help bring other people's eyes to our message. And I don't,
and, yeah.
and, like, I never feel pressure that, like, oh, I'm not doing enough, or, oh, I should be doing something different, or I'm not helpful. All I get is them saying, yeah, thank you so much. You're doing great work to help the cause. And I really appreciate that about the more decentralized
our local chapter as well. Yeah.
Version of the Green Party.
And it's interesting because, like, well, the New York Green Party is almost us in the California, maybe. We're kind of like the odd dogs
of it
because in most other states, it's ineffective. Like, we've almost, like, centralized our state party to some extent while retaining our regional locals.
Well, that's good.
But, like, it used to be more like counterculture where we, like, it was an anecdote, but, like, a guy showed up to, like, a state meeting in a robe, bathrobe. Yeah. And it's like, 'cause, you know, we didn't have standards or felt like we weren't enforcing a decorum or a standard of action.
Right.
Like, we didn't want to lose anybody, so we just let people be crazy. Sorry for the ableism, but
right.
Odd and unproductive. Or talk too long. Fast forwarding a bit, so he did the committee, and of course he hated every minute of it.
Right.
But then eventually he does, in fact, oh, yeah. And it's fun. Oh, God, so many good anecdotes here. This is, like, a great, like, I like this, like, his story quite a lot. I mean, he's a good writer. He knows how to tell a story.
Right.
And it's his story. It's from his perspective. So, but he also mentions all these little bits of where people are saying things about him that are just patently untrue. It's like, I'm not doing that. But
right.
Nelson, this guy, is saying that I'm saying the bad stuff, that I'm like right. I read Trotsky or something, and it's just like, no, I don't. And it's like, I'm not a spy, I'm not doing this thing, I'm not being anti-leadership, I just want to do things that are helpful. But see, but then the leadership is saying that I'm being unhelpful, so then it becomes this contradiction in realities. But then he mentions, like, a trial of Ross eventually, of, like, the nationalist, or the guy who's just more militant, too militant for his own good, let's say.
Right.
And they're trying to get him to go there, and he's convinced it's like a trap for him. Like, they're going to put him on trial, and then they're going to put me on trial. Oh, yeah, if I'm tricked, I'll fight. You hear? I don't trust Nelson. I'm not a politician, and I cannot anticipate all the funny moves of a man who spends his waking hours plotting. So they convince him to come, though, or at least they give him assurances that he was an intellectual, or that they hated Wright because he was an intellectual. This is the big problem they had with him, despite the fact that he was poverty, always in poverty, working through the aid society they set up to, like, and he was working at, like, the boys' club. And trying to grasp why communists hated intellectuals, my mind was led back to the accounts I had read of the Russian Revolution. There existed in old Russia millions of poor, ignorant people who were exploited by a few educated, arrogant noblemen, and it became natural for the Russian communists to associate betrayal with intellectualism. But there existed in the Western world an element that baffled and frightened the Communist Party, the prevalence of self-achieved literacy. Even a Negro, entrapped by ignorance and exploitation, as I had been, could, if I had the will and the love for it, learn to read, understand the world in which I lived. And it was these people that the communists could not understand. And he says the communists broadly. But he's talking about, like, the black communists on the south side of Chicago.
Right.
Particular, because those are the ones he's working with. The trial began in a quiet, informal manner. The comrades acted like a group of neighbors sitting in judgment upon one of a kind who stole a chicken. But the member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party rose and gave a description of the world situation. He spoke without emotion and piled up hard facts. He painted a horrible but masterful picture of fascism's aggression in Germany, Italy, and Japan. I accepted the reason why the trial began in this manner. It was imperative that there be postulated against what or whom Ross's crimes had been committed. Therefore, there had to be established in the minds of all present a vivid picture of mankind under oppression. And it was a true picture. Perhaps no organization on earth, save the Communist Party, possesses so detailed a knowledge of how workers lived, for its sources of information stem directly from the workers themselves. The next speaker discussed the role of the Soviet Union as the world's lone worker state, how the Soviet Union was hemmed in by enemies, how the Soviet Union was trying to industrialize itself, what sacrifices it was making to help workers of the world to steer a path toward peace through the idea of collective security. The facts presented so far were as true as any facts could be in an uncertain world. Yet not one word had been said of the accused, who sat listening like any other member. The time had not yet come to include him and his crimes in the picture of global struggle. An absolute had first to be established in the minds of the comrades so that they could measure the success or failure of his deeds. Finally, a speaker came forward and spoke of Chicago's South Side, its Negro population, their suffering and handicaps, linking all that also to the world struggle. Then still another speaker followed and described the tasks of the Communist Party of the South Side. So it's like this long digression of Socratic, you know, dialectics of, like, why do we care about what Ross said about black businesses or something or other? And he goes on about how the emotional weight of, like, you know, it's not that Ross asked for forgiveness. You know, he is guilty. It's all very clear. By this point, Ross has, Wright has left the party on his own accord. But then he goes from WPA job to WPA job, but he's hassled and it's all made very bad by members that are now shun him. Because once you left the party, you get the cold shoulder, you don't exist. And if anything, if you try to coexist, they punch you in the face or flash knives in your face, as happened at one job where it was a theater where he met, you know, like he points out, like, they had only done vaudeville before.
Right.
And they wanted to, like, do things that were popular or things that wouldn't get them, like, hated.
Right.
So it's like, we don't want to try anything new, different, or avant-garde or written by white people. Or adapted or something. Like, no, it's got to be something we're comfortable with. But they didn't know what they wanted to do. But so they had this anguish about, like, being stuck, and, like, they want to be taken seriously, but they also don't want to do anything serious because they don't know what to do. So he brought in, like, a Jewish playwright, and they hated that, and they threatened them with knives. And in the end, it's May Day, and his union local from the WPA, you know, experimental theater, they they basically like gave him the wrong time, and they didn't want him marching with them because he's a problem. And then as a friend of his, as the section that he used to be part of in the Communist Party, one of his old friends says, like, come on, it's May Day. We all march. And he's like, I don't know, man. Everybody there hates me. You know, it's like, no, we all got to march together. Come on, got to march. It's May Day, right? I wish we had this guy. I mean, this is the attitude I have when it's May Day or Labor Day. And I'm right. Like, come on, march with us. Stop, you know, get out of the street. We all march. We just march together. So this isn't a show. This isn't a show for you. Get out. You know, it was Pride or something. Like, come on, march. You know, we're marching together. It's Pride.
Yeah.
We should do that. It's not a show. It's not something to make money. It's like, we're marching. We're marching together as an act. Collective unity action. Can't process it that way. Oh, no, of course. I don't want attention. People will be looking at me. I'm not comfortable with that. But then he basically gets shoved out and almost hits his head on the curb.
Oh, no.
And that's where, like, he's, okay, sitting. Suddenly, the vast ranks of the Communist Party began to move. This is after he'd been tossed aside. And by the way, it was by white communist members that shoved him, and all the black ones watched. Suddenly, the vast ranks of the party began to move. Scarlet banners with the hammer and sickle, emblem of world revolution, were lifted, and they fluttered in the May breeze. Drums beat, voices were chanting, the tramp of my feet shook the earth of their feet. A long line of set faces of men and women, black and white, flowed past me. I followed the procession to the loop and went into Grant Park Plaza and sat upon a bench. I was not thinking. I could not think. But objectivity of vision was being born within me. A surging sweep of many odds and ends came together and formed an attitude, a perspective. They're blind, I said to myself. Their enemies have blinded them with too much oppression. I lit a cigarette and heard a song floating in the sunlight air. I remember the stories I had written, the stories in which I assigned a role of honor and glory to the Communist Party, and I was glad that they were down in black and white, were finished, for I knew in my heart that I should never be able to write that way again, should never be able to feel that simple sharpness about life. I think I can stop there, but there was another line that was printed on the back of the book that I'll be for them even though they are not for me. Now, when I read this on the book jacket, I thought it was like he was organizing with white communists, but they had innate, you know, white supremacist biases, right, or worker focused biases, and they weren't for black workers. No, these were the black workers that were not. He didn't fit in because he was too much of an individual. Now, what's kind of torturous to read in hindsight is that the shift that right represents, and the ex-communists, and the message of the book from the German is that, or no, from the Italian communists, is that the real battle will be between ex-communists and communists.
Yeah.
And this is kind of played out in mid-century politics, and how, like, you know, the people who were most, and eventually, you know, the opposition to the Communist Party in the Soviet Union are the Trotskyists, various types that then become the neocons in America.
Yeah.
Or raised by them. But it's also Wright's kind of way of thinking, one, like the black nationalism, that we need to go our own way, stop with this international struggle stuff. Right. I mean, it was still there in the civil rights movement. Of course, you know, you have Muhammad Ali, like no Viet Minh called me an N. The civil rights movement and MLK, it's all about, like, you know, anti-war, anti-imperialism. Imperialism is what keeps the black man down. You know, they knew this. There's still the residue of it. But by the 70s and 80s, it had all but dissipated. It was all tramped down by assassination and culture shift and just being beaten all over and over and over again. As we kind of explain or go through the ideas that fall out from this kind of the things that happened in the interwar years and the war and everything that happened after. But like the shift to thinking of feels and meme warfare and culture war, and just how, like, they focus too much on workers. They focus too much on worker struggle and unionization. All these writers throughout mid-century and beyond. And it's like, but now it went too, did it just go too far? Or was it really a matter of, like, we shouldn't have dropped it. We just need to add this.
Right.
We need to add the anti-hierarchical thinking, and then let's go, you know, let's not be so dogmatic, but let's keep the unity of action.
Right.
But these were the battles that were happening in the new left in the 60s. These were the arguments being had. And the winners seem to be we need to keep to informal organizations, because as soon as we make formal ones, the police crush us. And it's kind of where we're at, where Antifa can't be a formal organization.
Yeah.
If we did, we'd all be in jail.
Yeah.
As long as we have this, our own plausible deniability. It's like, oh, I'm not a member of anything.
Right.
I'm not, you know, of course I can't be jailed for being, for my activities, unless it's an individual shooting spree or going postal.
Right.
Or, you know, hey, it's just one person. It's not a movement. It's not us.
Right.
There's no real BLM. It's that you have all of this decentralized, unorganized movement of informal groups that are doing protesting and trying to exert political pressure. But it also doesn't seem to have, they don't have their own media. There's no mass media that supports them, say, in our area.
Right.
And the way that Times Union, the Hearst paper, covers BLM protests. And that, like, well, you know, the police say that they want to talk to them, but they're not, they're being obstinate in not talking to the police when they want to talk to the mayor, and the mayor's, and this is Saratoga,
right,
where they're going to arrest anyone blocking the street now. It's like, well, they had their First Amendment right, but now they're bothering, they're harassing diners. Beautiful diners. So this has been the Three Left Show. Thank you for listening. We have the second hour coming where we'll be lighter and hopefully a little more back and forth, right?
Yay.
Then, so join us for that, and thank you for listening. This has been WCAALP. Don't know, but please support us. Please support media like ours. Mass media is required for mass movements and mass political power that we need to, quote-unquote, change the world, or at least little bits of it at a time. And do that community, build that community action. Community radio for communities like you and me.
Yay.
Bill Bailey belonged to every radical party that ever came to be. Till he finally decided to start his own party so he wouldn't disagree. He got himself an office with a sign outside the door with Marcus League in letters red. And to everyone who came around, these were the words he said. Oh, you may be a friend of Max Shackman, Jim Cannon, and you may agree. You may get along with Norman Thomas and with Algernon Lee. You may be an old-time wobbly and think Jay Love's so fine. Yes, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine. For 17 years, Bill Bailey kept his office with the sign outside the door. But he never, ever got a new member. Everybody made him sore. And then one night there came a big fire, and through the flame and smoke, as the firemen rushed in to save Bill's life, these were the words he spoke. Oh, you may be a friend of Ben Giflau, Reverend Musty, and you may agree. You may get along with Emma Goldman and with the SLP. You may have belonged to every radical party that ever had a line. Yes, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine. And so on that day, Bill Bailey passed away, and his soul to red heaven flew. He was met at the gate by old Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, too. They said, welcome, comrade, as they opened the door to let Bill come inside. As he slammed the gate back in old Carl's face, these were the words he cried. Oh, you may be a friend of Karl Kautsky and a pal of Ferd LaSalle. You may get along with Wilhelm Leibniz and the First International. Yes, you may have inspired every radical party from the Hudson to the Rhine. Oh, you may be a comrade to all of those folks, but you ain't no comrade of mine.
Okay, and welcome back to the Three Left Show, where your leftist reading hour and discussion of the issues, how to organize, or rather, like, what's in our way, what can we do better as the quote-unquote left, or what would it take to even have a left? But now we're go lighter.
Right now, we are going to talk about... It's really funny. It's one of those iceberg memes, if you haven't seen it, and it shows... So at the very top level...
So the above the waterline are things that are almost like sort of like you might know about.
So it's like the USSR is the reason the Allies won World War II, Labor Party entryism,
Well, let's go through them one by one because I think each one represents like a certain set of ideas or an idea that is important to understanding the left overall, especially like this is for the outsider or the person who's maybe curious. So why don't you go one by one? So like there's Dem, it says Labor Party entryism, but let's say it's Dem Party entryism.
Democratic Party entryism.
Yeah, so we discussed that enough. But
using the Democratic Party and trying to pull them left. Mm-hmm. And
the idea that the Soviet Union, with the majority of casualties and the majority of the war effort, did more to win World War II because in comparison, the battles of the U.S. and U.K. and then the Allies in Africa and the Ardennes were just a sideshow of the actual conflict in the Eastern Front.
Right.
Everything was just so much bigger, so much more massive. It was war where the war was really, really existed. What's another one here? On the top level.
We'll go one level at a time. Level,
And as you go down, the ideas get more obtuse or weird, but like what I want to discuss has each one kind of makes sense through whatever backwards thinking that
first starts. It seems as though this meme was made by an ML, so that just seems like that's what
some of the references go to that. So that's the theme we're going with today.
So
this episode.
Another one, Chomsky works for the State Department.
Yes, so like this goes for like
Chomsky denounced the USSR for their authoritarian practices, which like, yeah,
he's but, even if he doesn't mean to, he's kind of serving American power by putting down other like actual not actual socialism, but just say the socialism that exists in the world,
right?
And saying this isn't good enough. It's pure like the critique is that it's being purist, but also just ignoring the situation that others are in. What does socialism in America look like? You know, what's the socialism that we are looking to build? And seems like we can only just resist imperialism little bits at a time and have our small victories. Because as far as by not having unity of action, we're just small victories. It's always just small victories.
Yeah. Oh, and there's another one. Robespierre did nothing wrong.
Yeah,
which is just a generic revolutionary guillotine.
Yeah, it was like
idea.
A lot of bloodshed, but what else was going to happen if you were going to make things actually liberalized?
Right.
Otherwise, you're just going to have a constitutional monarchy, because that's what the Jacobins they stepped in when the constitutional monarchy was kind of being settled, but this wouldn't have changed the structures of poverty or anything. Just the form of government towards.
And then it goes, the USSR suppressed the US labor movement in the 30s.
Yeah, that's an odd one that I can't quite explain yet.
Yeah.
But if you just look at the experience I just gave of a more free thinking communist of like, you know, this is if you just look at how like, oh, it couldn't just be the incompetence or the dogmatism of American communists that kept their movement from growing further,
right?
Or actually left out from my analysis / coverage of the God that failed is that what really, and I've mentioned this in the past, but like what really messed up socialist organizing in America was when the Soviet Union, to buy time, started, and also for the geopolitical angle,
right,
signed the treaty with Nazi Germany.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Actually, go further than that. Like this goes to the meeting that he had, where this shift to the general front. Like, oh, we need to work with middle class people. We need to stop working with just like ignorant working people. We need to like go into the churches. We need to go everywhere. Right. You can't just do your little like boutique writing thing and write your novel and reach people that way. We need to do this. Yeah. And this wasn't just in the South Side of Chicago. This was in every socialist org in that existed. And so like when the Soviet Union and the International decided,
right,
this is what we should be doing, it really diffused the organizing from strikes and militant action to the kind of entryism that has been done ever since.
Yeah. Then the last one that I want to read that's above water is Bernie Sanders used to be a Marxist.
Yeah, he's not like, anymore.
I wish.
Yeah, but he is, but it's like you follow dem entryism.
So now we go down to...
But I want to... The defeatism ones, because that's something like part of the joke is that there are certain things that repeat, but they just like instead of... So Revolutionary World War One defeatism.
Oh, okay.
That like, you know, this is imperialism eating itself. We should let that happen. Let the empires collapse.
Okay.
And then all that was once directly... lived has become mere representation, which is the motto of the Situationists. The whole like, you know,
the symbol loses its meaning.
Yeah, that we just have symbols. Trump is a symbol. The debates are symbols. They don't really. They were babbling. They didn't. They weren't talking about anything of consequence.
I don't
derive meaning from it. If you do, you're a cure.
I saw a different meme that compared the debate between Biden and Trump to the Family Guy fight between
him and the chicken.
No, actually, between Herbert the pervert and the Nazi.
Oh, okay. I don't know that part.
Of the super old Nazi and the two old white men that were trying to be friends with Chris.
And another line in the top one is the OSS was created by ex-communists, which, you know, the ex-communists are the true enemies of the like that will be the struggle.
Right.
And something mentioned by one of the other writers, the Italian one, I think, is that like, well, there were also all these they also became cults of opposition.
Right.
And that's kind of how you get the new left or the left that's like Chomsky, where it's just oppositional and it doesn't build new things.
Yeah.
Or new orgs. Something to replace. The Communist Party wasn't replaced. I mean, there were attempts to replace it by, say, like Students for a Democratic Society. But as soon as they started doing dementryism and got a candidate and ran against, you know, by 72, that it all collapsed. And they were left with like to reassess. And they all just kind of scattered to the winds, more or less. Going one down. So you have Demism. Kosky was right. Kosky was like a social Dem German.
Okay.
So he was like kind of on the fence with World War One, but definitely anti-Bolshevik. So he was right in that, like, you know, acid Corbynism, which is the acid socialism, is the idea from it was Mark Fisher's last work before he died recently, a few years ago. And it's the idea that we need to reinvigorate the counterculture. That the left hasn't been countercultural enough. We've kind of like left Twitter has fallen into these bourgeois middle class morality and identity politics.
Right.
And we need to be countercultural again, and that, you know, that would reinvigorate our politics.
Water.
So let's go down below water to the obtuse. So go ahead.
Stalin was a person of color is
yes.
the first one. Because,
can you explain that?
Well, Stalin came from the
Georgia.
And Georgia is like
mountainous region, not
the
civilized.
In the Middle East, like on the edge of like the Middle East and what is considered Europe to what is considered Asia. So
certainly to Russians, it wasn't like you're not European.
Right.
So he's not European. He's sent more closer to Central Asia.
Right.
And thus not a white guy.
Yeah. Stalin was a person of color.
Then you have Holmendor didn't happen. Holmendor is the Ukrainian famine, but that is very much like, ugh.
Well, that's when I read that, I'm like, ah, yeah, this was written
by a tanky. Yes. Yeah. Vanguard within the vanguard.
Mm. So you need to have the...
your own society within your obtuse party. Yes. It's very cringe.
I like Lenin was an agent of Kaiser Wilhelm II.
Now, this is from an obtuse piece of information that, so Lenin was not chilling, but exiled and living in Switzerland during the first Russian Revolution, which toppled the Tsar. A social democracy, or at least a republic, was being sort of built in Russia, though it was very unstable. And of course, the war was continuing, so it was all very bad.
Well, it was split between, the power was split between the Duma and the Soviets. And it was a struggle for power between them.
More or less. Germany, or the German government, Kaiser Wilhelm II, then gave Lenin permission to pass through Germany to get to Russia to disrupt things further.
Yeah.
To destroy.
And I was like, hey, Lenin, I know that you've written some things about things you'd like to do in Russia.
Yes.
How would you like to go try and
get your chance? Yes. And thus, win the war for Germany, which the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was very advantageous to them. They basically, once the Bolsheviks took charge, they basically did surrender.
Yeah.
So more or less, they needed to end the war. That was their main promise to the people. And so it's like, indirectly, Lenin was doing their dirty work.
Right.
Funny. Anarchism is liberalism.
Liberalism.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. This is the one of the tanky positions. But here's how could you believe this?
Right.
When you just kind of put individual rights first, you're kind of doing the same thing that our ruling class does.
Yeah.
The ability to make money, or you just make money to survive and do your own thing, like write novels, like Wright wanted to do. And then you don't have unity of action. And if you don't have unity of action, then you're not really a communist. You're not a comrade.
A comrade is anyone who opposes capitalism.
That's the way we're defining it. Yes. That's the way we define it. But as far as, like, say, the Communist Party that was, that beat up Richard White, it was. And this is why, like, the MLs of today are just trying to get back to, like, unity of action. Like, we were something then. At least we were something.
Right.
Yeah. So you get where I'm going with that. And let's see. Secret speech was the first copypasta. So the secret speech was when Khrushchev denounced Stalin, but he couldn't do it publicly at first, so it was the secret speech. And copypasta then refers to it just being, like, a paragraph that you just copy and everyone repeats it.
Right.
And are you meant to take it seriously? The other thing is the USSR tried to suppress May 68. I'm not sure why MLs believe that, actually.
I don't actually.
So I guess we have to let alone.
Know what that's referring to.
Yes. Let's go another level down then. Mm. And by the way, so the meme structure goes that as you go down, you give like this guy who's well kept. Nice haircut, and he gets scragglier and scragglier and a bigger beard.
It goes from a normie to being,
you know,
say radicalized isn't the right word.
Yeah.
I would say it's...
The depiction is basement-dwelling psycho.
Like, there, each level is a level deeper in your mom's basement.
Yeah, but then the last three, which we'll get to, where it goes full insanity.
Oh yeah, the last three are completely under the iceberg.
Yeah, yeah. Once you go beyond that, though, then you're truly enlightened. Universal being.
So that it goes
next level down.
Revolutionary World War II defeatism.
Yes,
that just
like the fascists need to win first, and then we can beat them. Because, like, well, see, the whole thing of the United Front is we need to beat fascism first. And this is what we're told by our progressive and liberal friends. We beat fascism first, and then we can build push our policies, the policies we all agree on. But this is not what happened after the war. The New Deal fell apart. I mean, it continued for 10 years, but then it did not progress any.
Right.
And then we had to keep fighting communism. And then LBJ learned the hard way, apparently this was a big mistake, that once you're at war, you can't have social progress. You have to drop all of that.
Right.
And since we're a perpetual war, we can never have social progress. And this has been the case since World War II, since we became world policemen, replacing the British. We should have lost the war, so to speak. It would have been better for the left.
Sock Dems are social fascists. Did you explain
this was
a
line that actually came up from the German Communist Party, that this is what they said ostensibly. Like, we're not going to work with the Social Democratic Party because they're social fascists. Like the, well, you know, scratch a liberal, a fascist bleeds.
Oh, okay.
That's what it's just referring to. It's literally the same phrase.
Yeah.
But just different terms. That the,
our
progressive friends they're fine with fascism at the end of the day. They're not.
Right.
But they're with us or we're with them when it comes to, say, opposing the camps or opposing what Trump does. But as long as it's Trump, as long as it's done with the racist coat.
Right.
If it's Obama drone striking Arabs, it's, well, you know, at least as far as like social Democrats, Democratic Socialists, on the other hand,
right,
are closer to us, like AOC, and they will call that out. But then there are social Democrats, let's say Anthony Weiner, like the kind of like the progressive heroes of Democrats before 2012.
Okay.
Social Democrats like Kamala Harris. There's still, you know, for the cultural state, you know, there's still lock up all us lefties.
Yeah.
Or oppressed people.
Then it goes Posadism, which I love Posadism as an idea.
Very popular.
If you don't know, Posadism is the idea that a pure socialist society of worker control can only come into existence following total nuclear war, and that it requires a nuclear annihilation of the world in order to bring about socialism.
I would also describe it as like Cold War defeatism.
Yeah.
That there should have, like, the Cold War should have gotten hot.
Right.
And thus actual conflict would have created the conditions, or, you know, in the post-apocalypse, new societies can be built. Or rather, it's just the position that the Soviet Union shouldn't have went with this coexistence line, which started with Khrushchev, but actually continued to be. Well, of course, Stalin wanted that too. Actually, it was the British who was like, we got to beat the Soviets, and that's why.
I'm scrolling through this, and it doesn't seem to have one of my favorite ideologies, which I mentioned either last time or the time before to you, eco-posadism. Which is the modern day version of Posadism, that instead of the big crisis being nuclear winter or a nuclear war, and that's what needs to happen to bring socialism. Eco-Posadism says, no, we need a climate catastrophe. We need to have.
It is here, but it's called something different. It's
revolutionary
climate change defeatism.
Oh, that's what. Okay, then I'll mention it then.
Yes.
I'll talk about it then.
Let's see. DSA entryism is at this fourth level, where it's like, because the DSA has all these caucuses, and some of them are like MLs, or revolutionary. They're militant.
Well, the DSA has an anarcho-primitivist caucus.
Exactly. So that's entryism there, and that actually exists. It's not just on the
right.
It exists, and it's like, but what kind of pull are they really having in the party? In the way they kind of. Or when it comes to their positions that they're voting for, but when it comes to the strategy of like not endorsing candidates
Democrats.
Yeah, the leadership still holds the cards, and the leadership are still like the ones who started the party thing in the 70s.
Right.
We'll skip radical dialectics. There's no such thing as the white proletariat.
Oh, yeah.
Which is to say that here in America, you're not the working class, or the people who are, you know, not white. You know, white supremacy puts white people on top. So the whole, like, it's the frame of mind where, like, you know, we're always trying to push back against it that the working schlubs in the Midwest aren't really the proletariat. They're not really working class because they're benefiting from white supremacy, or they're benefiting from the American economy. When all else fails, and this goes to something lower down, I think, but really it's referring to the fact that, or the opinion that as Americans, we're still at the top of the global pyramid.
Right.
And that the 2 billion that are living on less than a dollar a day, they're the actual working class, which is kind of a Maoist position too.
Huh.
Maoist point of view. Go one down.
The USSR won the Cold War.
Yep. I don't know how you spin that, but there's a way of spinning everything.
Trotsky was trolling.
He was trolling.
He was just trolling.
Now, when he was kicked out or exiled from the power imbalance there, and he basically spent the rest of his life, I mean, denouncing fascism as well and saying that's what needs to be taken care of.
Well, he was in Mexico City writing books that were like...
No, yeah, he went from country to country.
Well, he spent most of it in Mexico, I'm pretty sure.
The last few years it was.
Like, he was just writing books, and it was like, yeah, Stalin, I don't like...
I don't like him.
I don't like him.
Don't like him.
Don't like it.
They're doing everything wrong.
I would do it different.
They're doing it, yep. And then it becomes then the cult of opposition. Just because he's being oppositional apparently makes him right. Or that, like, he just spent 10 years basically denouncing the Soviet Union and saying how they're doing it all wrong. And this created its own cult of personality. But, hey, he was just trolling.
He was just trolling.
It didn't really mean it. Situationists were a psyop. So going back to, like, you know, the breakup of the left in America doesn't come down to this, but part of it is the whole, like, everything's just an image, man. We don't really need to organize workers, man. That's what we're past that.
Right.
We got to base, you know, it's identities, it's our lived experience, man. Let's go back to the land.
Right.
You know, we got to work on our culture war issues. We got to fight we need to make our new culture. This is like situationism's impact on the left, and the whole, like, everything that was solid is now just representations. If everything's just representation, then we just need to fight for better representation. And thus you get the liberal identity politics that, you know, we argue about. And it was all created by the CIA. Now, this comes from the actual reality that a lot of postmodern art was funded by these shell groups that were CIA money.
Really?
Yeah, like Warhol. It was indirectly, like Lex Luthor.
I have a short anecdote about Andy Warhol.
Go ahead.
I found one of his most interesting pieces of artwork the other day. It's titled "Come," and
go on.
It is the materials to create this artwork was
dumb.
That I read that some
whatever, but yes, it's funny.
It's true. Andy Warhol made artwork using human bodily fluids,
and he's not the first, definitely not the last.
Definitely not the last.
And this destroyed the left, so obviously the CIA did its job. You know, once the modern art flew off, it's like we couldn't. Couldn't organize workers anymore, you know? But it's very simplistic to think that way. It's like, it wasn't just that, but it also wasn't like, it was part of the transformation of, we're not going to follow the orthodox Marxism
anymore.
And
of course, we've got Bella Delphine works for the State Department.
Yeah, so I had to actually look this up again because I didn't recognize the name.
Oh.
But Bella Delphine is the gamer girl bathwater.
Yeah, exactly.
So she's created, not created, but she influences e-girl subcultures. Yep. So could you explain why maybe an ML would think that she creates, you know, the e-girl subcultures online are just like,
well, because
they're part of the web of the state.
She's a staunch capitalist. Mm-hmm. And that she just sells shit and makes money off of incels. That's what
right,
she does.
Right, yeah, right, yeah. The gamer bros and the alienated.
Exactly.
She's doing the work of the capitalism, of capitalists, and in the most extreme way, which kind of then, if you take the conspiratorial framing of, like, I'm going to read into this.
Right.
It can't just be somebody just following pure ideology the way they're supposed to. No. She's got to be paid.
Right.
You know, so they got to be agents.
Well, it's the same thought process
of the deep state.
The two of us have to be funded by Soros because there's no way that we would ever be doing this if we weren't.
So ML, so the craziness, the obtuseness comes in that way.
Then we go down a level, unless you want to talk about temporal single system interpretation.
Yeah, so I actually looked up what that is via Wikipedia.
All right.
So what it is, it was in the 1980 response to the labor theory of value. So a few of these lines refute to, like, once now we're like getting to the bottom of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And so now we're going beyond just the people and the ideas of historical fact. Now we're just going to argue about Marx's theories of value, because if we get that right, everything else just falls into place.
Yeah.
And I want to stress that I have been in the room during such a conversation at Left Forum. There are these panels of people who argue about Marx's theories as if that once we figure this out, everything else, like we'll figure out how to best organize,
right?
How to think about how to reorganize the economy. It all just makes sense. Makes sense. And so, like, there are a few lines here. So this is the first one out of three. So out of like a joke of like threes, single cell system is that any problems with the labor theory of value are a matter of interpretation.
Okay.
Marx is always right. If he was wrong about something because of, well, he was writing in the Victorian era, it's just because we're, from our modern standpoint, we're misinterpreting what he really meant.
He didn't mean what he said. He's always right.
He was never wrong. It's just we're biased
wrong.
From our we're poisoned we're... by modern art. Good. So a level down from that. Yeah, that's the last of that. So now we're down to level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Level
now we're
six
down. This
out
is the bottom
eight.
Of
the iceberg. So the next one here related to that is Orsinarko's theorem proves Marx was right. So Orsinarko's theorem was developed in the 60s. It's that if real wages are constant, the rate of profit actually goes up. And it basically is meant to take into account innovation and the way capitalists innovate.
Okay.
Some Marxists responded that it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
So it's just kind of like, it doesn't matter if the rate of profit's going up. It doesn't matter if there's innovation. But if you take into account that, if you add in the new rules of economics, like constant wage share that Marx didn't have, that it actually, the labor theory of value does work out.
Okay.
So it's like saying, like, look, every time you try to disprove Marx, you're only making him more right. Oh, yes. And then no such thing as the working class.
Oh, okay.
No such thing. No such thing at all. Khrushchev was trolling.
Ah, yep.
So all that stuff about Stalin, everything about, you know, things being bad before him.
No, he was trolling.
Didn't make, you know, just... And thus, like, the entire shift of Soviet Union policy and the Cold War, all the way it played out, it was all just a joke. Extremely long quantitative waves. So in 1925, there's economic theories about seeing patterns in the way modern society has developed.
Right.
So there's different cycles. We all kind of experience them in boom or bust cycles.
Yeah.
Some are 10 years long. Maybe some are 20, depending on patterns of, like, the waves could be shorter, the waves of, like, boom and bust, based on inventory boom and bust, investment, short-term investment, right, or infrastructure investment, which would be, like, 20, 30 years. But long waves are based on actual technological shifts, which go more 40 to 60 years.
So, like, the advent of the internet.
Yes.
Triggering one such.
Or the advent of coal power and rail.
Or the Industrial Revolution.
Exactly.
Triggering the world wars.
Exactly. Looking really long scale, and thus you're being a very deep thinker. But the basically you have the four-step cycle: prosperity, recession, depression, and then improvement. Mm. So when you have, like, say, in the short term, when Trump talks about, like, the economy is doing better than it's ever done
so
before.
It's so good. It's never been better.
That's the improvement. We're on the improvement side.
Right.
We just went through the depression side, at least in terms of year to year or decade to decade. But if we're thinking big, got to go technological. In fact, the internet is our, you know, improvement. Then we're doing the investment of, you know, nuclear weapons right now and the plutocracy. And then the real crisis and the bust will come in 2050.
I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. In this section level, there's the Sino-Soviet split never happened.
Oh, yes.
So, like, if Khrushchev was trolling, you know, it's like, so the Sino-Soviet split was the split between Soviet Union basically saying, we're coming to accommodation with capitalism or with the West to
right.
avoid nuclear war, right? Good move in hindsight. But also,
That sounds like Dengism.
Well, No, the split happened in the 60s. So you had Mao basically going, no, no, we need to keep up world struggle.
Okay.
We need to fund the subgroups and all that. And the Soviet Union was kind of, the split was more about, no, let's do less of that, because every time we do it, we bring the American army. We get the ire of the Americans.
Right.
They invade the country where we attempt to fund organizing efforts or guerrilla groups.
Yeah.
They escalate. And then threaten nuclear war.
Right.
We want to avoid nuclear war. So we're going to stop instigating these things. We're going to do a little less.
Okay.
And try to do it. We'll be more judicial in it. But Mao did not want to do that. So there was a split.
Okay.
But it never happened. ML believes it never really happened. Again, because Khrushchev was just joking and all that stuff. It was Soviet Union never really. It never changed policies, which is sort of how. You know, the right in America kind of views, like, it's all one thing. There's only one communism, and it's all the same. And it's never changed course at all. It's all one evil empire, completely continuous.
I saw,
which is insane, which is also,
I saw a tweet
nuts.
By Thought Slime, and he was like, people that go to the extreme right because they're annoyed by leftists are weak. Real leftists are annoyed by other leftists every single day. And it only makes them stronger.
Yes. Baptism by fire. And by the way, this meme was taken from new theories, new developments in horseshoe theory.
Oh, of course. Oh, okay.
In horseshoe theory, if you don't need that review, is that the right, the extreme right and left are the same. It's like a one dimensional political spectrum bends like a horseshoe.
Right.
And meets, and it's a circle. Let's see. Going on, we have Lenin's last letters were Trotskyite forgeries.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, Lenin's last words were like, don't put Stalin in charge. Trotsky is the person that I would want to be my successor.
Right.
This is pretty ahistorical. Either the last letters exist, but like the reality was like they had their differences, but they had made up, so to speak,
right.
Trotsky and Lenin. But otherwise, there are other people, and this is like some YouTubers argued this pretty well, that there were better people that could have taken charge besides Stalin or Trotsky. There was this other guy, Bukharin. He was popular.
Well, it was the fact that Trotsky wrote about his opposition that he became viewed as the one big alternative to Stalin.
Stalin, yes. Which wasn't actually the case, if you study real close.
GOP entryism.
GOP entryism.
That we need to run primaries against GOP candidates.
As socialists.
Bring the Republican Party closer to the left.
Yes. Now, this also makes sense with the whole, like, MLs are more like right-wingers and reactionary. Like, the reactionary politics of MLs these Twitter or these online leftists would appeal to them because there's chauvinism and there's like, you know, get your identity politics out of my face. Let's just focus on workers' rights. And then we can appeal to flyover people, flyover states. So it makes sort of sense. And there's a lot of people who are saying these kind of things. So is it really that deep and crazy? But GOP entryism, there are like these, examples of socialists online mentioning like, I'm in red country and I'm gonna run in the GOP primary.
Yeah.
And
then it goes revolutionary climate change defeatism.
Yes.
Which goes into what I was saying earlier about eco-pessimism.
Yeah, start with this Green New Deal stuff.
So it's no Green New Deal. We need the climate to get worse.
Yes.
So then it can get better. It's the idea that littering is praxis.
The littering is not connected to climate change, but yeah, sure. But the whole like, let's keep polluting. Once the climate collapses, capitalism won't be able to function.
Well, it's the ultimate accelerationism.
Yes, exactly. It's more accelerationism in the long-term acceleration. That's what makes it better.
Right.
So the same level, the last one in this, there's only four. There's less of them in each one. The tendency of the rate of profit to rise, which is the Oceaneros theory. But it's also kind of saying that like, no, like what Marx really meant, right? This is
what he really meant.
was that actually profit has a tendency to rise.
Oh.
But also it does, and then it crashes because it can't sustain that level of investment.
Because complete unfettered rise and growth is impossible.
It's like agreeing with the Heritage Institute. Like, look, profit will always rise.
Because it has to.
It has to, and it'll keep consolidating. And then profit has
to always rise.
And it will become state capitalism.
Right.
Which is where, like, the whole, like, look, we don't have real capitalism. We have corporate.
We have corporate
state, you know. Yeah, it's like state capitalism. Yeah. Which is like, well, you sound like an ML. Exactly. That's what anarchists say about the Soviet Union.
They were state capitalists.
Yes.
And down a level, I've just laughed so hard when I read Stalin didn't know how to read.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Which is a kind of like, it goes beyond like he's a person of color. Not only that, he was actually really dumb.
I can't read.
Yes. Well, see, it comes from, where does this come from? You had all of these detractors. All the detractors of Stalin were like, he's a dumb guy.
Right.
He's dumb, and you just go to the extreme, like, yeah, he didn't even know how to read.
Yeah.
The other side of that is Trotsky committed suicide.
Oh, yeah. He ice-picked himself.
Mm-hmm. His last act of bravado.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the true way to oppose Stalin. Was to just like, I'm not yourself. Doing this anymore. Yeah. I'm not fine for socialism.
Then it goes, commodity fetishism was meant literally.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I love
my pillow. My pillow guy.
Oh my God.
Take me. Dialectics as reconciliation between quantum mechanics and general relativity.
As someone with a bachelor's in physics, yes. That one gets to me.
How does it get to you?
Well... quantum mechanics is the physics of the very small and how the particles interact. And general relativity is more the physics of the larger and
yes.
how bigger things interact. And dialectics is the science of Marxist-Leninism that society change. Well, they have nothing to do with each other, of the physics and the science, but it's the idea that dialectics is science. And that it is the yes. immortal science of Marx that will
always
be
proven right. Well, it's philosophy
right.
from Hegel.
Well, what it means is it's the idea that society gets better and that
things interact and then you get a synthesis.
There
that's,
was
yeah.
tribalism. Tribalism gave way to feudalism,
yeah, linear.
Which gave way to republic, which gives way to democracy, which will eventually give way to socialism, which will then give way to communism.
Yes. Which is linear historical thinking, which is not too different from the way Christian ideology works, which
yeah.
is where the whole, like, you know, you call Marxism not Western Civ. It absolutely is Western Civ. In fact, if anything, like the critiques of Marxism is that it's too Western centric. It's too much like millennial Christian thinking
right.
of like, we'll get to the promised land and milk and honey, and we all just have to die first in fiery explosions.
Yeah.
Let's see, the other one here then is Marx forgot to finish Capital.
Oh yeah.
His series are so good, he didn't even need to finish them.
I remember I tried reading Capital and I got like, oh my God, I could only get through how many pages talking about the relationship between the value of cloth and coats.
Yeah, yeah, very
the labor that goes into them necessitates the
and that's like you said last week, you're going to translate it and make it iPhones.
Oh, that yeah yay.
Okay, last, we're now in the page, the very bottom, the represented by pureness with the universe.
This is enlightened thinking.
Yes, Gorbachev was trolling.
Oh yep.
Yes. Reverse. Let's do that one last. Reverse Podadism.
Ah, yes.
Which is, so the other aspect of Podadism that you didn't mention was that the idea that, and it's bundled together, but they're not. Is
right.
that?
Oh yeah, the other half. I forgot.
Change from society comes from the outside. There needs to be some external factor. Now, in our case, let's say the external factor is climate change. But of course, the dialectic is, well, we're causing climate change, so
right.
it's all just kind of one big ecosystem, so to speak. But let's say some outside force, let's say it's an invading force, of people then change, like that forces the change in the society that was closed before.
Which is the the space communist ideology?
No, that's what I'm getting to. I'm getting to that.
Sorry.
You ruined it.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, so what is outside of our world civilization? Aliens, of course.
Oh, of course.
So, and aliens, any civilization that has space travel, like, say, Star Trek, have to have some kind of socialist economy. They have to be the communists. Because they are the level of civilization beyond ourselves, linearly speaking, right? They've reached enlightenment. They are the enlightened space commies. And so they will come in and then save us from capitalism. They'll instigate the whole uniting of humanity trope. Not through invasion, but through like a rival giving us the truth, the tools that we need, the good sci-fi would show. And so podazism is like the space communists will bring us enlightenment. Now, reverse podazism is through our struggle, we will create, we will be the enlightened aliens that bring space communism to the universe.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And then finally.
Finally. Give it to us.
Baudrill invented Animal Crossing.
Bachelard, yes.
Now,
do you understand that?
I don't understand this one.
Bachelard is one of the main situationist thinkers. So it comes back around to the situationism of everything is an image. Everything is a representation. And it was Animal Crossing. Representation.
Of capitalist society?
Not so much, actually.
Okay.
This was a take that was put out by someone else, maybe it was Jim Sterling, probably not, but that what makes Animal Crossing appealing is that you're collecting things. You're extracting value and turning it to pay off your debt and make stuff, right? But you're actually doing stuff to earn it. Like, you're not doing some bullcrap job. You're not making it for capitalists. Like, there's the debt holder, right? But, like, in anarchists would point out, like, communal societies have kind of debt in them that we're all indebted to each other in a way.
Right.
And that's kind of how Animal Crossing works. But it's a representation of, like, the life we would like to live where we collect butterflies or apples or shovel things. And
or that also in Animal Crossing, all the bank loans have no interest.
There's that as well. Yeah. And that's a big factor. That debt is, you can actually pay it off.
Right.
Unlike in reality. You can pay off Rocky Raccoon.
Yes, you can.
So it's just saying that, like, yeah, the situationists created the media landscape that we have.
All right.
Case closed. That's all you need to know.
Makes sense.
So we have 10 minutes left. Just China's
Trump COVID memes.
Go ahead. Yeah, let's fill it
up. So I think this is a good way to end it. Trump, if you haven't heard,
has
got
COVID.
The Rona.
Yeah.
Celebration
time? I talked about this with my roommate already last night. I don't think it's worth arguing about whether he'll survive or not or something. It obviously doesn't change. I mean,
he's getting the best medical care.
Yes. But so did Herman Cain. So it's not a sure thing. But Chapo was mentioning that, like, Bolsonaro, it's like now a hobby of his to get COVID.
Yeah.
He's spreading COVID in Brazil. He gets it so much.
I think this is the twist ending.
Boris Johnson survived, and he's not a guy who's in shape.
This is the twist ending that I never expected it would be the way that the final season of America would end on.
It's the season finale of this season.
Yeah.
But years are a temporal thing, you know, they're representations, the years. I mean, they exist in that, the turning of the seasons, of course, so we can measure it that way. But when's the seasons mattered in our lives except how we react to the weather?
Yeah.
And it's, in certain parts of the country, it's all about escaping the changing of seasons.
Right.
Just ask anyone in the Sun Belt.
Oh, yeah.
Trump corona memes.
So the memes have been fantastic. Everyone collectively decided this is something that we shall all comment on. So I made a meme.
Well, that is how we do political action.
Right? I made a meme, and it was the top half is the Trump tweet where he goes, "Tonight,
at FLOTUS and I tested positive for COVID-19. We will begin our quarantine and recovery process immediately. We will get through this together. And then underneath that,
stronger, better than ever.
Underneath that, I put the image of you know the video of the
dancing pallbearers.
Yeah, of the dancing guys carrying
from Ghana.
Carrying the coffin, and they're just dancing and having a great time. I just put a picture of the four of them standing next to each other looking at Trump, and that was funny. I also, there was a different related one where it was Trump, and he's getting friend requests, Facebook friend requests.
Yes.
And he's like, ooh, I have notifications. He clicks on it, and then it's those guys. And they're the friend request. He's like, oh, no.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, the pallbearers.
Yeah. Yes. And it's just a lot of people. Oh, here's another good one. It's, you know, the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where it's Mac and Charlie dressed as rich people mocking.
Where
it's like,
did somebody get
you're
the
hoping
disease?
The president dies. You're sick. Leftists after receiving death threats from white right wingers for 5 years straight.
Yeah.
Is someone seeing the consequences of their actions? Oh no. And then it's like conservatives a week ago. Fuck your feelings. Kill all leftists. Lock Hillary up. RBG is in hell. And then conservatives after Trump tests positive for COVID. Please, guys, you're being very toxic and disrespectful. So much for the tolerant left. You have no idea how bad you look right now.
We don't care how we look. We've been caring how we look for decades, and it's only got us some small victories.
There's another one.
Militant protests is something I'm with because it's like, look, we did things other generations did things the nice way. You did some nonviolent disobedience. Sometimes, you know, it's the good activists, right. Even the good activists, the best activists, Medea Benjamin, they're still just winning the small victories, or rather they're living in the stew of opposition, and the organizing is not like this whole, like, they bemoan the lack of an anti-war movement.
Right.
They are the anti-war movement. And it's like, how you, like, the question of how do we grow this? How do we get bigger? What would it take? What does it, like, what are we, you know, what are we doing wrong?
Yeah.
But it's always kind of we're not doing things terribly. We're doing things the way we feel that they're best done, the way we see it. But that's also like, we're still thinking in a lack of unity of action, you know, because to get people to act in unity requires a hierarchical structure.
Yeah.
And that's old thinking. We need to kind of have a new thinking where we can have unity of action like in Rojava, but still be decentralized and democratic. We use, you know, online tools.
Confederalism.
Yes, we use, yeah, exactly. We use online tools to facilitate the discussion, like on, what's it called? Online voting tools, liquid democracy, the ability to, you know, with instant messaging, consult with people while or when we are making decisions about them.
Yeah.
Unlike Richard Wright's case, where it's like, look, we decided. It's like, look, and in his mind, it's like the decision matters. If we don't follow these decisions, we can't act in unity. We might as well be, you know, suffering in silence.
Right. Here's another meme.
So, yeah,
it's from it's of the Joker.
Gotta practice that better way.
Yeah, the Joker on the Franklin Murray Show, if you remember the movie.
Yeah, I saw that one. You shared it.
Let me get this straight. You think Donald Trump getting COVID-19 is
funny?
And it's like, I do, and I'm tired of pretending it's not.
I had a thought about this news where, especially with like the debate as well and the various reactions to it. So Matt Christian's reaction was like it clarified something that I realized in 2010, that nothing in the political class, like whenever they're talking, matters.
Yeah.
My realization was when the public option was taken off the table during the process of creating the ACA.
Wow.
It's like everything that was said during the campaign, the Obama's campaign when he won, beat Hillary. Everything in the 2 years when the Democrats held all three branches of government, everything they were talking about was complete bull. Because as soon as they were creating the ACA, it all just fell, it didn't fall apart. It was just, it was clear that it was capitalism that controlled the
right.
process. And everything that was said in any political debate or meet the press and on the news shows, it was all theater. It was all, didn't matter. There was no reason to assign meaning to anything that was said.
Right.
And whether or not it played well. So Matt Crispin or the Chopper Trap House guys, they're realizing this apparently right now. And Matt also had to be very high as well.
Right.
Which is another strike of like, why did you need drugs to figure out that between Biden and Trump being on stage and babbling like children, like that's what it took to realize that nothing they say matters? But it's like, I guess so, because before they could at least talk in full sentences. And apparently this was what made them believable. Or like you could convince yourself that what they were saying mattered. But none of it matters. Please accept that none of it actually matters.
Yeah.
Political power is in the hands of the people paying the bills.
Exactly.
We need to pay some bills of our own.
Yeah.
And this goes into a short byline about our own local argument about signs, which is pretty much settled by the money.
Yep.
In the material circumstance that we're not going to print signs and distribute them because the costs are much more than you would think. Certain political campaigns that raise $100,000, distributing hundreds of signs is easy. But when you have a few thousand dollars, our lowest quote was 100 signs for $400.
Wow.
And getting them without the wires, which I have left over from another campaign, only drops the price $80.
That's
or 40. It was inconsequential.
That's atrocious.
And right, so we rather spend that money on text banking and lit and stuff, which is what we're going to do. From our very productive meeting that you were kind of half referencing before, where it's like, look, you're just you didn't make it, but it was a very productive meeting as like. Many meetings, Zoom calls, whatever. It just feels like you didn't accomplish anything. But, I mean, I kind of like the candor of the Green Party. At least when we actually have more than four people in the room, it actually does feel like we're accomplishing stuff. Because we're all talking about what we're doing, what we have done. Even if it's very small stuff. But at a group of 10 people, it's like, oh, we are kind of doing our part. It feels like we are in part of something bigger. Especially when we refer to or report back from this or that. And the collaboration with Socialist Alternative and Socialist Party locals as well, that they're working on creating a clearinghouse org for leftist collaboration going forward. Not that we'll be maybe one unity organization, which is what I would like, but we can at least have something where we're collaborating. And I would love to be a delegate in that.
Oh, yeah, that would be
though
awesome.
Though it could backfire where we have three-hour meetings where we're just kind of talking about the situation. But I don't think that's going to be the case because that's not what we do in our meetings because we're all on the same page. We already know what the situation is.
Yeah,
I think it's only when Mark Dunley, a true veteran of the Green Party and a lot of other things, will lay down like the reality of like, let's not be optimistic about this. We may lose online. And once we do, our main strategy will then shift. We're going to keep on keeping on. And that will mean leaning on the Dem socialists in New York politics, the Dem entryists, to do the reforms that we need.
Yeah.
Either so. But it's like, I'm not optimistic about that because like, well, they have their entryism. They just feel like they've gained political power and they didn't need a third party to do that. But they're sympathetic. I mean, we met with some Democrats already that were sympathetic to actual democratic reforms. But when it comes to it, like we could have 100 of them in the state government and it still wouldn't matter because the leadership will determine that. And this is the argument happening on Facebook pages all over. Okay, we're out of time. And so thank you for listening to the Three Left Show. Visit our Patreon page to support us materially. Facebook, Twitter, also for new episodes every week, which is podcasted, and so on and so forth. Keep waving the flags of the Three Lefts.
Hell yeah.
Have a good one.